I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 1983. The album, The Adventures of Bob and Doug McKenzie, Strange Brew, excerpts from the original soundtrack. The artist, Bob and Doug McKenzie, a.k.a. Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis. My guest this week is Eddie Schmidt, returning. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Yes, thank you.
I said that so fast, it sounded like your name was Eddie Schmidt returning. That is not...
It will be now. I will be changing it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
That's big I'm announcement.
Honored. I'm honored. So I love that you you assumed, I think, when you originally messaged me about this, you're like, oh, wait, you're talking to Dave Thomas. We won't have anything to talk about. Not true. As you will know from Dave Thomas's episode, he remembered very little about it, the record. So, right. Which is good. It feels like an improv session like the other one does. I have no idea how much of it is written, but I want to know, A, when you first saw the movie, what's your experience with Bob and Doug McKenzie, and did you own this record growing up?
Yeah, I can answer all those. So my first exposure to Bob and Doug was the hit single Takeoff, featuring Rush's Geddy Lee. That was a beloved treasure when I was probably about 10 or 11 when it came out, and bought the 45, still have it. It's pretty worn. I think the B-side is L. Ron McKenzie, the religious send-up, shall we say, and love them both. Hadn't had any exposure to SCTV at that point. And then when Strange Brew came out, I guess I probably was in seventh or eighth grade. And I remember seeing the commercials on TV and thinking, I gotta see this. I gotta get to this movie. And then it was gone. Like I couldn't even get to see it. By the time I was like trying to go to see it, it wasn't around.
Right.
And then I didn't really know. Oh, and I should say, and I listened to the whole Great White North album then after. I think I had it on a cassette, or like, you know, somebody copied it for me. So the whole like 12 Days of Christmas and The Beer Hunter and all those classic routines, you know, totally soaked them up around at the same time. And then never knew that this album existed at all. As a matter of fact, I think I'd heard that maybe there was this, you know, a second album or some kind of soundtrack, but I thought, oh, it's probably just score or something like that. And then no, I did a little digging and realized, like, wait a minute, it's a whole other record, and it's both a soundtrack to the film that has dialogue, and then it's an original comedy album commenting on the making of the film and the making of the soundtrack album. So it has all these meta levels. And so, you know, during the pandemic, I decided I needed to rescue this for my soul, and went on Discogs, purchased it, I think for about $14. I think if you look on Discogs, the last time that it sold was in June of this year to me. And then, yeah, went down the rabbit hole of, like, you know, lost pop culture garbage that I'm like want to unearth, and I'm happy to do it with you.
It's funny because this is harder to find. Great White North is easier to find, therefore cheaper. This one's a little on the harder to find side. You picked, okay, so the only other time I know of a record that has done this is the Python, the Holy Grail record, where they kind of also mix sketch with clips and sort of commenting on the movie. This is its own thing. It is much more like the Great White North, but the Strange Brew movie, I don't know that this has probably happened in other situations, but I don't know a ton about the history of this, but the Strange Brew movie happened because of the Great White North album being so successful. So I think this is the first time we've ever talked about a record that exists because another record made a movie happen. I don't think we've ever had I don't think that discussion has ever come up. It was such a hit. It was such a huge friggin' record. And it's funny then that this record didn't sell nearly enough to be, like, you know, as a follow-up, and it was their last one.
No, and I kind of don't know why I said pop culture garbage, but I meant that lovingly. In other words, I almost think it's part of my job in a way to, like, shine a light on these things that have somehow not made it into the digital era and should. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think Great White North is still widely available.
Yeah.
And this, which I would say, there's a lot of really funny stuff on here. And if you're a fan of Bob and Doug, like, there's, you know, you see a lot of stuff online like, oh, I wish they would get back together. Yeah. I wish there would be new Bob and Doug. And it's like, hey, you don't have to wish. There's a whole other record out there that's hard to find. And you know, with all the reissues, I think, like, Shout Factory, like, get on this.
Put this out,
you know, because if you're a fan, this is it's a gift.
Yeah.
And I, you know, did a little bit of research, and it looked like this won, I think, the sort of Canadian Grammy or the Juno Award for comedy album in 84. Mm-hmm. And they accepted the award. Like, in other words, you know, it's not like, it's not like it was immediately lost to time, right. You know, it's sort of, but over time sort of forgotten. Right. And, but the movie has a legit cult following. So there's just mm-hmm. no reason that this can't exist alongside of it.
Yeah, that's very strange. There, I mean, there's also another thing that went along with this is another one of those weird pop culture side things where, and I've got this in a few situations where there's also a stupid book that goes along with it, which I really would like to get. Also, as out of print as this record is, probably expensive and hard to find. But every once in a while you'll find a little bit of ephemera that goes along with a record or goes along with all this promotional stuff. And it's very strange that this goes by the wayside, especially like you say, given the cult following. I will full disclosure, I only saw Strange Brew once, and this was in like early high school, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. And I wasn't as exposed to Bob and Doug McKenzie. And my mom was like, oh, you're going to love this. I'm like, I don't know what I'm watching. I don't appreciate who Max von Sydow is. I don't appreciate half the stuff. You know, friend of the show, Paul Dooley is in it. Who else is in the damn thing? There's a ton of great people in it, but.
Yeah, those are the only ones that jump immediately to mind.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Okay. As far as like.
Well,
big names.
Mel Blanc doing the voice.
Oh, yes.
Of
right.
Their
there's
dad.
The other one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I didn't get it, but did you, when did you finally see it?
Oh, I guess I saw it. Yeah. Great question. And that was where my mind was going, probably either late in high school or in college. Mm-hmm. And I really loved it. And at that point I had loved Flash, the Flash Gordon movie, mm-hmm. but didn't, you know, put two and two together, but certainly seeing it in college was like, oh, Brewmeister Smith is Ming the Merciless, who's also this respected Swedish actor. Yeah. I don't care about that. I just care that he was Ming the Merciless and Brewmeister Smith. Now, those are two exceptional cult mm-hmm. movie roles. And so I really did enjoy it when I saw it in high school or college, probably watched it a few times throughout. And I'm very proud of my sister. This is I know that we're blood because in college, my sister Lauren wrote a paper, actually, about the similarities between Hamlet and Strange Brew.
Yes.
So hats off to her, which of course, oh you know, God. they reference in the film, in the mm-hmm. album, but to actually go to town academically, I mm-hmm. give her a lot of credit.
I want to read this paper very much. So good.
Maybe we can make that available as a web extra. I'll have to see if she can pull out of her attic or something.
I read the original script. It was like there were all these weird, and I think I talked with some with Dave about this a little bit. Dave, like we know each other, with Dave Thomas about this a little bit. But you know, there was a lot of contractual bullshit with SCTV that they had to contend right. with. And I also did read that the original script was like so beat by beat the Hamlet that they were like, we need to rewrite this. This needs to be more Bob and Doug and less strict to the bard. Which I'd like to right. read that script, but.
I would too. I was going to say, you know, when first if someone's listening to they go, what's Eddie Schmidt's connection to this? Well, really none except, but actually I was once at a party with Steve DeJarnett, mm-hmm. the third credited screenwriter. So yeah. I have that tenuous connection.
Sure.
But I would want to read it because he also made a movie called Miracle Mile. That's a really interesting cult movie with Anthony Edwards mm-hmm. that's well-regarded from the 80s. So I wonder, but it's interesting to hear Dave Thomas talk about it. And by the way, if you're listening to us talk about it, definitely go back and listen to your talk with Dave Thomas. It's great. He does a great Max von Sydow.
Uh-huh.
He has filled with stories. I thought it was you did a terrific interview.
Thank
with
you.
Him.
It was a lot of fun.
No, you're welcome. And I guess I wondered, like, I didn't find it, and when I watched the film, to be as disjoint. He made it seem like, oh, it's really two movies, the part that they rewrote, the first third, and then the rest of it. And to me, it seemed like it was just a silly, surreal, goofy comedy the whole way through. I, not knowing the backstory, wouldn't have thought, oh, this seems to not relate the two parts of the movie. I actually would go on further, though, to say that that whole opening of the movie, which is the bad sci-fi movie, the mutants movie, which, by the way, now at 2021, we're only 30 years away from the McKenzie brothers post-apocalyptic future. We're getting closer. But I found that whole opening of making this bad movie and having the film break and the audience chase them angrily out of the theater, I found that to be pretty brilliant.
That's great.
Actually, I just didn't mind when they then went off and had the mouse in the beer bottle, evil brewmeister adventure. I went with it, you know.
Yeah. It's I'm sorry, but hearing you describe it verbally does make it sound more disjointed, but it
I
makes
guess, but, but no more disjointed than any other sort of like outsized comic duo does a movie in the 80s, you know.
Big time.
By the way, I wanted to talk about the single from this, because there's a song, like, and Dave Thomas said on your show, he had said that when they did Great White North, that Rick Moranis, who came from radio, said, well, you gotta have two songs.
Yeah.
They had Take Off and the Christmas song. they sort of skirt that here. They have one mix of Strange Brew, the song, and then another mix. So I guess they do have two songs, but it's really just one song.
I would have killed for another Geddy Lee song is all. It would have polished that thing off for me.
I know. I feel like that would have sailed this one into the top 20 again, and maybe they just needed to work harder. But I do like the song, and I think it was Dave Thomas's brother, right? Ian Thomas did the music here, and I do enjoy it. I do like the song, and it falls into this like weird subgenre, 80s subgenre of these movie songs that have bits of dialogue that are like goofy novelty singles. Like there's the City of Crime, the Tom Hanks, Dan Aykroyd rap from Dragnet.
Oh shit! Yes, forgot about that.
That you should definitely seek that out. Probably not, you know, worth a whole deep dive, but it is.
Where Chet Hanks got it from. Oh shit.
That's right.
Dragnet's responsible for Chet Hanks.
Yeah, there's a proud lineage of rapping in the family. But that has bits of dialogue, and then Spies Like Us, which I guess technically the video has the dialogue in the mashup. The actual single is just a McCartney single. But I bought the 12-inch single, and that does have a remix, much like Strange Brew, where there is dialogue from the film and the song. And this song, Strange Brew, is no worse than Spies Like Us.
No.
Let's get real.
Sure.
A bit ahead.
Did they do that with any of the Mel Brooks ones? Because I know Mel did a few, again, Mel, my good friend Mel. But Mel Brooks did a couple, like he did the Hitler rap.
Yep.
And then I think he did It's Good to Be the King as a rap as well. But I don't know if there were ever any with interspersed dialogue or if it was just his quote-unquote raps.
Yeah, though that's a great question. I think his records didn't blend them, but he did a number of great, and you've probably covered his comedy, like High Anxiety, Sung from High Anxiety is wonderful.
It's brilliant. Ooh, I need to buy that record. That's one I really am angry that I don't own of all.
That's another one that I got on Discogs over the last several months with I forget if it's called Mel Brooks Greatest Hits, essentially.
Right.
But it has High Anxiety. It has, If You're Gonna Love Me, Say It Loud, that song also in High Anxiety. But it's got Blazing Saddles. Like, if you love Mel Brooks, like, you really deserve that record.
Yeah, I need to buy that one.
It's To Be or Not to Be, that soundtrack that has the Hitler rap.
Yes, right.
On it.
That's right, thank you. I couldn't remember if it was that, or it wouldn't have been History of the World, Hitler's Only on Ice in that. That's where my brain was going, because Hitler's in so many of his movies, it's a little hard to keep track.
Right,
which is fair, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go.
I was going to ask, I was going to point out, this is just like the first record in terms of it's very meta, it knows it's a record, number one. But it also has this extra layer because it's playing a clip. They are talking about a clip they're about to play from a movie, the movie. Then they play a clip from the movie in which they're also addressing you about the fact that you're watching a movie that they're in. So it's got a few levels.
Yeah. Well, and then as we said, in the movie, they've made a movie that, you know, falls apart, which they're then on the run from in the movie. So there's you got to give them credit for a lot of meta levels for early 80s. Comedy, but it's very reflexive of knowing that it is a record about the making of a movie, and then many of the original sketches. And we should really point out, like, again, I would say most of the record, or certainly more than half, is original. They are, if you enjoyed the bits from Great White North, you will enjoy these. But it is all about the making of the movies, particularly, like, they goof on a lot, like the role of the director.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the director calls, you know, action, cut, lunch, and break. Like, mm-hmm. that's the mm-hmm. full role of the director, according to Bob uh-huh. and Doug. They goof on acting. Mm-hmm. There's the multiple runs at sort of, I didn't do it, you knob, and I did do it, you knob, and how to deliver that line, and who's a better actor. And so a lot of this is, again, really fun. Not only is, you know, if you like the McKenzie Brothers, but also this sort of, you know, goofy meta showbiz commentary as well.
Right. This is, and I wish I'd heard, again, I wish I'd heard this one earlier. I feel like I would have had even more of an appreciation for the movie. It now makes me want to go see it again because I have a rougher idea of what I missed when I was a teenager, I feel like.
Right, right. No, I agree. I actually want to go back and watch the movie again too because, well, we don't have Max von Sydow. He's no longer with us.
Sure, sure.
But they're just listening again as I prepared to talk to you. Hearing the film bits, mm-hmm. you know, you get a little Max von Sydow on the album.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah.
So you get to hear him say stuff like, "I'd crush your head like a nut, but I won't." You know, mm-hmm. he has memorable vinyl appearances because the Flash mm-hmm. soundtrack also has dialogue from the mm-hmm. movie.
And
I guess that might be another one.
And a theme song with dialogue cut into it, for fucking sure.
Right. Clytus, I'm bored. Plaything can you offer me today? I can't do it as good as Dave Thomas. He does it excellent. But those lines were burned into my head.
Yeah, of course.
And so, but it's interesting because, yeah, Flash did it. But in Flash, it is campy, but it isn't a full-out comedy vehicle. Of course,
oh, for sure. No, absolutely.
The other films that we were talking about. But before we leave Mel Brooks, I realized, and I wondered if this thought floated into Rick Moranis's mind when they shot Spaceballs. But of course, in the opening of Strange Brew, which is both on the record and in the film, they're goofing on a sci-fi movie and they are, you know, kind of doing some Star Wars lines.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so then, of course, Rick Moranis goes on to play Dark Helmet just a few years later in Spaceballs. And you have to wonder, do you think, that's interesting. I kind of didn't see that coming in my own career. Goofing on sci-fi and Star Wars, and here I am in a full-blown Mel Brooks mm-hmm. parody. You know?
I was actually just, this is annoying. I would have had it up here if I didn't, but I have my own Dark Helmet that I was trying to turn into a lamp because I played him once on stage, and it's sitting downstairs right now. I had to make it out of a garbage can, though. That's what I did. I had to buy a very large garbage can, cut it the right length.
Wow, yeah, because it is, right, you can't just modify a Vader helmet. It really is its own
so
shape. You've got
big.
Garbage can is actually a good, that's probably the way to go.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I got in everybody's way on stage because there's no room. We were sitting shoulder to shoulder, but when you've got a helmet that big, you make a lot of room for yourself. I will just say that. Oh, God damn it, Rick Moranis. I'm excited to see. I read also, and it's very annoying to me that they didn't do this, but it's because funding fell through, but there was supposed to be a second Strange Brew movie.
Yes, Homebrew.
That got some funding, and then Todd McFarlane said he was going to give them the money to finish it, and that fell through, and according to Wikipedia. And I'm just like, damn it, I would love to have seen what they would have done. This is now 20 years ago. My God. Yeah, so... Yeah.
Well, yeah, I agree. I was going to bring that up too because I think I wondered, like, gee, well, first of all, there's mm-hmm. obviously a script written for it. So why didn't they publish it or put it online? Or as a matter of fact, during the whole, you know, the height of the pandemic, they could have done a staged reading of that over mm-hmm. Zoom and mm-hmm. fans would have paid a pretty penny to watch Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas walk through mm-hmm. Homebrew. But even now, you know, like, I don't know, like, it's just sitting around. Just do it, guys. You could do it again.
It could also very easily, and I feel like I should delete this out of the show, it could be a podcast. And and if it's a podcast, then they could also comment on the making of the script.
Oh,
the podcast.
Hey, you might
Shit.
Be onto something, my
delete,
friend.
Delete all this.
Well, and They had a plum role for Dan Aykroyd, apparently.
Yeah.
And it made sense. It was at the height of the sort of microbrew craze, you know? I don't know. That's still sad.
It could still very well happen.
Maybe with our push to reignite the love for Strange Brew, the soundtrack, will bring an avalanche of love toward, it'll just be the snowball that makes homebrew happen. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Rick Moranis is back in the game, man. Like he's doing the new Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Yes. I don't know how much of it he's in, but, you know, he's in it.
He's in it. I will say that I went to, of course, years later, you know, I got into SCTV, which is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was too young for it at the time, wasn't staying up late to see it on NBC at that time, but got into it. And then, so I went to a panel in the 90s, probably mid-90s, at the Paley Center, or Paley Center sponsored, it might have been the DGA, when it was the cast of SCTV.
Oh, awesome. Wow.
Live. Holy shit. Showed clips, and they all talked Catherine O'Hara, Levy, I mean, and, you know, this is, of course, years before Schitt's Creek, and Rick Moranis.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick Moranis was dazzling. Rick Moranis was so quick, so fast. I mean, you just being, because when would you get the chance to see Rick Moranis live? Right, yep. Bantering.
Yeah.
And I was blown away. I remember thinking, like, wow, I've loved his stuff, and he's, I mean, all the Jerry Todd, all the stuff when he and Dave Thomas did the Woody Allen Bob Hope. There's so many brilliant things in SCTV. But to see him in front of an audience, it was really astounding. I remember thinking Rick Moranis is just like, he should be the top comedy. Like, he should be up there with, you know, Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he sort of went into semi-retirement for a long time.
Yeah.
But I just was blown away by him as a personality and as a comic mind on stage.
He needs a Wes Anderson to do to his career. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that needs to happen.
Yes. Yes. Or Tarantino, maybe.
Holy shit. Oh, my God. I don't even know. Can I tell you, I bet that is a clash of personalities that you don't realize would be explosive. And I think there's a half a chance Rick Moranis walks off the set if he doesn't throttle the man. Only because I just feel like if he's as pure about the art, he's also like been dealing publicly with obviously all kinds of things. They're the reason he didn't hop back into acting. But he seems like the kind of guy who's like, I don't fuck with stuff that bothers me. So he would probably walk off the set. He's like, no, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah.
And I respect the shit out of that.
He's a tough guy. We should talk a little bit about the music element and not just the song, you know, the sort of single. But so Charles Fox did the orchestrations for the movie.
Yeah.
And I will say, if you're a McKenzie fan, certainly of Great White North, one of the great thrills of Strange Brew, both on album and in film, is hearing the Kuru-ku-ku-ku-ku song with an orchestra, like the orchestral, you know, the Bob and Doug theme rendered by a 56-piece orchestra.
That's great.
Is pretty damn majestic. I have to say, and they do goof. We should say too that in the album, not only do they goof on writing and directing, but they goof on other aspects of movie making, including orchestrations.
Yes,
they claim to call in the 56-piece orchestra, then send them out for 56 pieces of fried chicken and whatnot. But Charles Fox, who, you know, was the arranger and composer of the score, I looked him up and I didn't realize that he wrote the music for Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. He wrote the theme to The Love Boat.
What? Okay.
Yeah. He wrote Laverne and Shirley, Making Our Dreams Come True.
Holy shit. Okay.
And he also apparently started out doing the music for Barbarella.
That's so insane.
Like, yeah. So this is like a major guy. Yeah. That they got to do this. Yeah. And then, now I haven't looked at this. Shit. Maybe some other super fan after listening to this will look it up. But apparently he wrote a memoir called Killing Me Softly, My Life and Music. So I don't know if there's any insights into the making of Strange Brew, but perhaps in those pages there are.
I hope to Christ there are. That's phenomenal. Yeah, I'm looking at a very quick part of his discogs, and this is an insane amount of records. Alone, and I'm sure this is never complete because Discogs never really is, but I also read that they did release the orchestration to this movie on its own record, but I can't find that at the moment. It's probably on here, but I'm not searching for the right thing. I don't know.
I wondered if that was an internet mistake that has been repeated because I don't see it anywhere. Like, I don't see it with a catalog number. I don't see it existing. And it does make me wonder where you go, okay, so they had a deal to do a record that had Bob and Doug. Would they also at the time have gotten a deal just to put the score out?
It does seem strange. Unlikely, it does seem like...
Maybe, or maybe it was put out as a very limited edition thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there is some score on this album, right? Mm-hmm, like in the dialogue parts. So it made me wonder if somewhere along the line, since this thing is so hard to find, that maybe people got it wrong. You know, they just
use
a confluence of ideas.
I'm now realizing when I go over to his, so he's got this limited number of like, there's his 16 albums on here. And then you go over to writing and arrangement. He has 1,326 records under his belt. So guess I misread. So there's a half a chance it's in there somewhere, but holy crap. And that of course covers like every cover of Killing Me Softly, which is about a billion.
Oh,
so
that's,
you know,
right. That's
that's what everything is on this one page I'm looking at. Killing Me Softly, Killing Me. Holy crap though. That's remarkable. I would love to know how that came about. And if it came about as insanely as getting Max von Sydow into the movie, like.
Right. Oh, that was a great story that Dave Thomas told, again, referencing your interview with him, where he was in the room with, I think, Freddie Fields. He said, like, an MGM exec calling Max von Sydow on the phone cold and then having to like pitch the movie to him. That's incredible. He must have had a great sense of humor because he did do these, you know, bigger than life roles.
Right.
As well as all the Bergman stuff.
Sure. And I mean, these are, you know, I've heard other stories similar to this. Like I know a guy who has, you know, had to commission a lot of art from a lot of people, and he's a big fan of like, shit, I need to get blobbity blah to draw for my company before they die. Or, you know, like he got Jack Davis, one of my favorite cover artists of all time.
Sure.
And like after he paid him the certain amount, he's like, I'm pretty sure that was just because that he needed to buy a new set of golf clubs. I'm pretty sure. So this could be like Max von Sydow's golf club movie. Although I'm, this is not to insult, he puts it in, like, you can hear that he's acting, he's not phoning it in, he doesn't do that, but
no, he does not phone it in. He
a lark nonetheless, I think, you know.
Yeah No, he definitely right, he knows what it is, but he doesn't hold back.
Yeah
He still plays it to the hilt. His scenes with Paul Dooley, I mean, Paul Dooley of course is a great character actor. Yeah. And I mean, brilliant in every Breakfast Club and just a million other things.
Mm-hmm.
Chicks the Clown. I do have the album here just to make sure. I wanted to make sure. Yes. I, you know, of course, you're seeing this, but nobody else is seeing this. But I do have the vinyl in front of me.
Yes. It's a good
just
cover.
In case.
It's a really good cover, honestly. It's a very good poster, too. But the cover itself is great.
Yes, right. You talk about Jack Davis. Like, this is Mad Magazine worthy, this cover.
Were there any inserts that came with the copy you bought? Or
no, it's just a plain white sleeve, unfortunately. Okay. But it's got a good back cover right here. There they are in the sanitarium. and then kind of like film strips, you know, a 35mm film with sprocket holes on the side from scenes from the movie. So it's kind of a nifty back cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this. We should say it is the only film to date filmed in Hozorama. they also say on the record, I don't think this was a joke in the movie, but on the record they say that it was filmed in 3B, which means it's better after three beers. Looks better after three beers.
Uh huh. Uh-huh.
Again, the more meta commentary.
Uh huh. There's explanation of the difference between movies and TV, which sounds like it's actually in the film. Again, I haven't seen the film in a long time, so I'm assuming that is actually in the film.
It is. Yep, that is in the film.
They walk you through the dumb... By the way, this is like improv filler, but because it's the two of them, it's just like, yeah, keep going. This is great. I could listen to these idiots talk. Then they do a whole bit about... Just because Rick Moranis his voice cracks, Dave Thomas is like, oh, you're going through puberty, eh? Oh, yeah, you got your pubes yet? Like, and it's just all a bunch about pubes. And
a lot,
oh,
yeah, a lot
are
of
you bald down there?
A lot of pube jokes. Yeah, a lot of pube jokes, actually.
And it makes, God damn it. It's one of those where, like, what podcast or what albums would qualify to be a podcast today? This is the kind of thing where, you know, it's got that, it's, you know, there's just such heavy improv on it. And
well, that's a great, really great point. I hadn't thought of that. I had, what I had thought of was like, oh, like comedy duos through time Mm-hmm. Really, it's funny arguing. That's really what it is. Like all comedy doers, essentially, it's funny arguing. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the podcast era, like that's there's so much. There's a proliferation of funny arguing, and not just between two people. It might be four people sitting around.
Yeah,
funny arguing.
Which is, I think, I didn't actively avoid that when I started this podcast, but I will say at the very least, I've never had to have a heavy argument on this show because I know how bad it would be. Bad news, you know what I mean?
I can't even imagine, like, what would you go to the mat for?
If somebody came on and said, hey, but you know, but Woody Allen's fine, I would have to then... I would have to be like, we're not talking about, I'm a big fan of not separating the art from the artist. And I feel like it would get heavy and argumentative my part. And that's why I avoid those albums on this show. So I don't have to scream.
Probably a good idea. There's nothing for us to really argue. I don't think we could really dig in on this one.
No, I don't think so. But we also both love it. It's a great record.
Yeah, but there's nothing really controversial.
No.
To go to the mat on.
No, not really.
I found it funny that because I think this was really, it's Mercury Records, and I think their Great White North was Mercury Records. It's interesting that they make a whole point, it's a runner through the album of the fact that this is not their second album, which of course it is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, till I think the final line before, you know, the needle finishes the groove is, I just want to, this is not our second album. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, like, why did they feel the need to make that distinction? Were they planning a legit second album that wasn't tied to the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's just another self-referential gag to just, like, argue about. Right. But it did strike me, like, they don't just say it once. They really say it from top to bottom. They want you, the listener, to know this is not our second album, but it totally is.
Absolutely is.
It is.
It's like, no, this is the soundtrack to our movie. We're just doing, it's got this gag that is something that I've wanted to do on a comedy album for a long time since movie commentaries have existed. I do very seriously, when I release my first album on vinyl, I do very much want to release a supplement that is commentary on that entire record. And that's what this feels like, though, is that it's commentary within it. Before DVD commentaries were a thing, of course. And that's what it feels like. It kind of roughly feels like badly made commentary for it. You know, this could play over the the DVD if they'd ever, you know, released it on DVD with this. Although it's shorter than
the record. That's interesting. Yeah, why did... Because I also have the DVD here. And there is no attempt at sort of commentary or anything like, nope, there's a few Bob and Doug cartoons, but you're right. They totally could have, again, presaging the podcast era. I mean, essentially commenting on pop culture and just look at what we're doing. We're just comment like, but they built it into the pop culture.
Oh yeah.
At the time. The other thing that we haven't talked about yet, is the idea of a love theme, which of course movies, you know, even comedy vehicles with ridiculous comic characters had to have a quote love interest or potentially a love theme. So they goof on that here, and they are talking about taking the oft quoted phrase "I did it, you knob" into a song.
Mm-hmm.
Then they joke about waiting. They can't pull it together because they're waiting on clearance. Of course, then they ask, what's he playing? Ha-ha, like as if he's part of the orchestra. But then they sort of go into the, you know, bit from the movie, the idea that there would be a love theme. Like Bob, they argue over, I think Doug says Bob knows about relationships only from greeting cards, which is funny. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sort of going all over the place here, but I love the idea that they're goofing on the love theme, goofing on the idea that there's a love theme in their movie, which is a goof. But then they also, they just have these sort of droll, dry, you know, whether they're making fun of actors or directors or relationships, their comedy works on many levels. And I think that's why their beloved is like, you could be a kid and just like them as a cartoon and it's, oh, they drink beer and burp.
Sure.
But they're also very smart. And there are a lot of smart jokes flying in there all the time, you know.
I'm tempted to draw a comparison between other Meta records that I happen to really love. And that includes the Python one. It includes anytime Albert Brooks is pointing out the fact that he's making a record. It is the fact that there's nothing remotely precious about their improv. There's nothing winky, even though they're breaking the fourth wall. To break the fourth wall and not be excessively winky, I think is like is really difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And it could be, and I think it's an element of the characters that they've already set up. It's an element of their fucking brilliant acting ability, frankly. But I think there's always a temptation, especially if you are now the stars of a movie, regardless of the size of it, there's the temptation to be excessively winky and while being self-referential, where they are doing it without. They're just like, no, there's no pretense. We're still these idiot characters. We're going to play these as calm as possible. Like, I don't know. This does not break tonally from Great White North in any way, so it feels so much like a continuation of the album, and that never happens when people get successful. There's always a slight tonal change.
You know? You're so right. And I think that's interesting because, yeah, they never have the urge to go to sort of say to the audience in a way, hey, I'm smarter than this dumb character I play. Right. I'm not really a dummy. They never feel the urge to do that. And even in the movie, like, I was watching clips from it and I remembered, like, oh yeah, through much of it, like, Rick Moranis looks like he just woke up. Like, his hair is all over the place. Like, there was no pretense of, like, well, yes, it is a comedy movie with a ridiculous comedic duo, but he has to look like a movie star. He's, because in a way, he's the romantic lead. No way. They make him look like he just fell out of bed. There's no vanity. There's no vanity. Maybe that, I wonder if that's slightly a Canadian thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the conceit, the showbiz conceit of, like, well, an America, a movie star, especially in the 80s at the time, well, you've got to be, you know, somewhat likable, lovable, macho. Like, there's no sense of that. Like, no, they're goofballs. They look like dirt balls. Like, there's no effort.
Yeah, even though they made it for, like, you know, a modest but still not nothing for 1983, $5 million, you know, so it's like, it's not nothing, you know, and they could have very much spent some of that money on polishing the Bob and Doug McKenzie look or any of it. But you're right. I love the idea that if there is hair and makeup, that hair and makeup is dedicated to making them look as natural as hell. And that's kind of, that's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. They're committed. Well, that's what, again, all the stuff that lasts, all the stuff that, you know, there's so many sort of so-called comedies that are successful in their time that nobody cares about 5, 10, 15 years later. And certainly after that. But these things that are just these sort of perfect artifacts out of time where somebody had this, you know, they just had a demented vision and they really stuck to it. Those are the things that last always.
Yeah.
I read, and I wanted to see if I could support this. I thought it said on Wikipedia that this was the highest grossing movie in Canada that year.
And I thought, oh my God.
Wait a minute. Like, I know it didn't do well in America, but
sure.
And I would assume that it would have done better in Canada, but the highest grossing movie of the year.
I would, like, love to know if that's the case. That's,
yeah. I don't know. Cause it's probably, maybe it's on like, would like Box Office Mojo or something have data for a Canadian?
Yeah,
probably not.
I wonder. Yeah. Canadian box office.
It's funny, like the analog world leap into digital. Like, that's one of the things where, like, yeah, you could probably say that, and no one, unless you're going to go look in an old newspaper or somewhere, like, no one can really back it up. And go, well, actually, it was like the 7th highest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was not the highest grossing, but it's, you know, it's on Wikipedia, so therefore you go, oh, well, maybe it was. You know?
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? What is this telling you? Is this? No, I don't need to know the top 10. Of all time in Canada, that doesn't. I also don't care. I very specifically, I don't care if Porky's was the best in 1982. I need to know about 1983. I apologize. I'm going to loosely do this research while we discuss
it. That's okay.
This is driving me crazy. I would very much like to, especially when you consider the highest grosser in the U.S. in that same year was Return of the Jedi. So I want to know.
Right. In Canada, they were like, nah,
fuck
screw
that.
Jedi, Bob and Doug.
We got these two guys. Oh, shit.
Well, if they did, hey, my hat's off to them.
For real. Yeah, damn.
I was just going to say, like, you would think if it was the highest grossing movie in Canada, that would have been enough that it would have gotten a sequel pretty quickly. Like, that's where I start to think,
fair.
I don't know.
Maybe. There's a bit in this that I enjoyed very much, which was it was more about the orchestra. I was like, oh, we got a special orchestra that can play Rewind. And then they rewind it and then plays back fast speed.
Yes. Another great meta joke. And I think it's interesting because, again, and keep referring to it, but your deep dive with Dave Thomas, like he talked about loving comedy albums and listening to them and it being part of his, you know, bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And Rick Moranis came from being a DJ. Mm-hmm. And like that whole Jerry Todd character on SCTV. But I think Martin Short was quoted as saying something like, well, the reason it was funny at the time is like there weren't VJs, there weren't video jockeys. So it was like a goof. Like, imagine they'll have a guy who's like a disc jockey, but for videos. So Rick Moranis was so ahead of his time. But because they were so focused on like audio creation and engineering and sound and records, that joke is something that you'd only come up with if you loved recording technology, like the idea of being able to, you know, play the tape backward and forward, but
it's true.
And play it as if that is the orchestra from the film. I know it sounds so trivial, but it's like, yeah, that's a really smart meta joke. If you love comedy albums and you want to like, you know, pay it forward.
Yeah. It's interesting because I don't often think about like when's the first time something like that hits, and that's probably the reason for it. But then it does kind of become part of the audio language of either comedy, well, usually comedy, something like that. Like the one that I think of the most that is now abused basically is the fucking record scratch to stop everything in a movie.
Right.
It had to have been done first though, and it is based exclusively on shared knowledge of how a record player works. And I would love to know. Damn, I don't even know. I'm going to have to look it up. I'm sure some nerd has written an article on Vulture or some shit about the origination of the record scratch sound, you know?
You would think. Yeah, that's probably right. Or The Ringer or something would have that. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, any of those places should try to get these guys to do an oral history of the making of this movie.
My God.
Why does that not exist?
I'd love to hear that.
Well, let's see. What are we going to be coming up on? Will it be 40 years in 2023? Yep. So somebody's got to commemorate that somehow, I think.
You'd think so. You'd think. Good God.
It looked like there was a fan-made music video on the YouTube.
I didn't see that.
This. Uh-huh.
Was it a good video? Was it well-made?
Well, it was taking pieces from the movie, so it was kind of fun. I was trying to prepare for my appearance here.
Sure. When's the last time you saw the movie all the way through? Do you think?
I want to say, I think I tried to watch it with my son when he was younger, and I think he enjoyed it, but I think he also found it like a little disturbing, like because it is a weird, the tone is weird, and like the brewery is creepy, and I think at the age that I tried to show it to him, I don't know, maybe he was 8 or 9 or something, like I think he recognized that they were funny, but it was like, this movie's weird. I bet, I could have probably shown it again and he would have been into it. But that was probably the last time that I watched it. But maybe I'll watch it tonight.
Yeah. I mean, the 80s had this way of being able to mix things tonally that I'm afraid of The Man with Two Brains, and I don't know why. I will never rewatch it because I have a gut hate for it. It's probably a great movie, but I have
it's
a gut hate of it from being a child.
Oh, because it really creeped you out.
There's something. There's a bit that I remember in it that I don't know is actually in the film, and I'm gonna rewatch it before I assert that it's in the film. So I'll have to rewatch it at some point and push through. It's literally giving me chills thinking about having to rewatch it, and I don't think it can't be that scary of a movie. But
no, it's not.
At 3, when my parents made me watch it, made me watch a lot of crazy shit when this movie came out when I was 3. So it's a little I'm damaged.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We could do a little therapy here. But it's interesting though, because I was prevented from seeing a lot of stuff that was, too much for my age group when I was little. But I think when you're kind of young and sensitive or impressionable, even things that are intended to be for all ages can disturb you. Like when I was a little kid, I was afraid when they threw pies at each other. And that, I would get chills. I would be so freaked out when you saw the face with the pie on it. When somebody got hit with the pie and then they would turn to the camera with dripping face. That to me, even now when I describe it to you, I'm getting the willies.
Oh, wow.
And I would have nightmares that pies were coming out of the television set and hitting me in the face. And I'd
holy shit.
Scream like as a kid. Yeah. And so, And that was from like the kids show Electric Company. They threw pies the time.
Speaking of Paul Dooley.
Yeah, so there you go. Okay. It all comes full circle. We had to find a way. It is. I'm going to write him a letter. A letter, not even an email, a letter. An actual letter. But yeah, there were characters. There's this character, Crank. And I think my nightmare was that Crank, who's like the grumpy guy, threw the pie and the pie came out of the TV and got
me. Oh my God, wow.
So look, that wasn't, you know, that was no R-rated comedy.
No.
That was supposed to be a kid's show. And yeah. I was totally, I loved Electric Company, but the pie throwing thing just freaked me to the bone.
Yeah, it's weird what tonal shifts do to you as a kid. Or like tonal inconsistencies or, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I say this in hopes that maybe you'll feel a little bit better knowing that even if your parents were overprotective as mine were, you'd still find something that would scare the hell out of you.
It's true. Well, the thing is, they wouldn't let me watch violence in movies, so I had to be scared somehow, I guess. Maybe as a kid, you're just going to be scared, and for some of us, it was pies. Man.
Just me.
Just
but,
you.
Though there, you know, I was scared by legit things, too, and again, you can't really protect kids. Like, there was there's like a very Z-grade horror movie that got advertised all the time when I was about 10 called Blood Beach. And my sister and I were terrified. And that would just be like on, you'd be watching cartoons in the afternoon and you'd see like, essentially it was like monsters in the sand on the beach. And that seemed so frightening because you go to the beach as a kid and you're like, well, Jaws, I know about a Jaws, but I'm not going to go out deep. But sitting in the sand, a monster's going to get me. So those Blood Beach commercials, forget it. We would never be allowed to see the movie, but the commercial was on at any time. And that was terrifying.
I bet. So, Blood Beach.
Blood Beach. One thing we didn't talk about, which was, you know, obviously the Cheech and Chong movies and records were hugely popular. And I have to believe that some of what caught fire under the McKenzie brothers, not their comedic intention, of course, because that had nothing to do with it, but in the industry was, oh, it's Cheech and Chong for kids.
Very much so. That's a good point.
Don't you think?
Yeah, and I mean, that's probably an early example. I'm certain they only got movies because of the success of their album. So that's it's a good thing you brought that up because you would think I'd have thought of that first, but yeah.
Well, because the Cheech and Chong, I mean, albums, you know, pretty great. I mean, they have and the songs, Earache My Eye and stuff, like Basketball Jones, like a lot of great stuff. Interestingly, I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think they're, after the movie success, I don't think they did something like Bob and Doug here, where they had a soundtrack that was both, the legit soundtrack and commenting comedically on the making of the movie. I don't think Cheech and Chong
did. I haven't seen it, but yeah, and I know most of them. So,
but interestingly, they did go back after the movie career started to wane, and I think it was sort of after Weird Al's popularity, they went back and did another comedy record, Get Out of My Room.
Oh yeah.
Which had a bunch of songs and sketches, which, you know, it was a fun record. But it's interesting how they then went sort of full circle. Like the McKenzie brothers, in other words, have this artifact that we're talking about, but they didn't go back and go, well, the movie didn't do great, but it did pretty well, and we're gonna do one more. We're gonna do a record again to try to either reignite our, you know, movie career, or because we love these characters and they deserve the second record that we're saying this Strange Brew soundtrack is not. They didn't do that. And I guess I have to believe it's because, certainly for Rick Moranis, that his on-screen acting career and other people's stuff had taken off. So they
I mean, Ghostbusters is a year after this, so I'm assuming, right? It must be, no, I'm good.
A while. And Dave Thomas was doing a lot. He did like a Lorne Michaels produced show called The New Show that was on NBC around that same Ghostbuster 84.
Right.
So yeah, I guess they probably figured, we don't need those characters, you know, or people don't want them, which, you know, wasn't true, but
sure.
We never got that other record or that other movie.
I know something's got to be out there, guys. If you're listening, you're not listening, but somebody send this listening. I'll send this one to Dave, and then my good friend Dave, and then somebody else send it to Rick Moranis, please.
I do think, though, that Shout Factory, maybe there's legal things we don't know about, but certainly fans like go on eBay, go on Discogs. Like, you can get this record and you will be richly rewarded. You will enjoy it. You will enjoy owning it, gazing at the cover as I have, and the back cover, and playing it on vinyl, flipping it over, just really get into the old school vibe. But there's no reason this shouldn't be out in a digital realm. Some company should get on this.
Or CD, even, from what I saw. I don't see that it was released on CD either.
Never. So, I think it did get, I think there was a cassette.
Oh my God.
I think there was a cassette. And the kids love those cassettes these days.
Yo, well, weirdly, they are back, and I don't understand it. There are people who will insist, no, if you got the right kind of metal tape, they sound great. All right, well, you never had a tape player that ate every tape you put in it, apparently, because come on.
Well, right, or would just, yeah. I remember I had a tape player that just would introduce, like, hits into it. So then, like, the more you played it, the more kind of analog hits it would just pick up.
That's so weird.
It almost sounded like it was being crunched, like being eaten a little bit, like clink, clink.
I am shitting on the concept of releasing something on cassette, even though I have something planned that is only going to be released on cassette. But listen,
avant-garde.
It's going to sound terrible, and that's part of it. You're just going to have to deal with it. If it gets eaten, it gets eaten. Mm-hmm. That's just part. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's part of the whole package. Do you have a favorite segment on this record?
Yes, let me take a look. What I was going to say as I look for this is, it seems like they made a concerted effort to make You Knob the this year's You Hoser.
It seems
there's a lot of You Knob back and forth of calling each other knobs, hoping that would catch on as the.
Well,
as...
How do you spell knob? It's with it with a K. Yeah, NOBK. It's a silent K. Such a dumb bit.
You know, interestingly enough, if I'm being really honest here. Mm-hmm. And maybe I just have terrible taste. I enjoyed all of it, but I do really have a soft spot for the theme song. I have to say, it is catchy in a very dated way, and it's fun and goofy and makes me think of the movie. But also is another interesting, you know, deserves an asterisk because, of course, the famous song by Cream, Strange Brew.
Oh, sure.
Is probably what's the title of the movie, but then that song is not in the movie. So they create another song called Strange Brew to commemorate the movie Strange Brew.
Yeah.
But it is delightful. And
it is
delightful. And actually, the missing link in our timeline here is that when I went to college and was a college radio DJ, I would find the records that existed in that library that nobody gave a shit about. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the 12-inch single to Strange Brew. So I think the statute of limitations has passed. There was a certain point where I just thought, I'm going to borrow this for an extended period of time.
Sure, of course.
From the call. I don't think anyone will miss it. So I do actually have the 12-inch single of Strange Brew way before I realized that there was a whole album to go with it. So it does... Yeah. You know, it's been with me a long time, and I think that may be my favorite track. What is your favorite track?
Boy, okay. Let's see. Let me pull up the actual track listing because I'm not going to remember the names of everything, and I have a terrible memory for these kinds of things. So let's pull it up. Or not. Fuck this thing. Apologies.
Want me to read them off?
You know what? Sure. Why not?
Okay. So here we go. Side one opens with This Isn't Our Second Album. That's the opener. Mm-hmm. Then we go to Film Dialogue. Welcome to Our Movie /Mutants. Mm-hmm. That's the next one. Then it's Mutants of 2051. So that's also tied in with the film. Then I Didn't Do It, You Knob, which has some acting lessons. There's Mouse in a Bottle, which is Film Dialogue that includes Max and Paul.
Yeah.
Then there's the song Strange Brew.
Sure.
And then there's a very quick behind the scenes where they goof on production design.
Uh-huh.
My wife is a production designer.
Uh-huh.
So that's funny. And then we go to side two, which opens with Shakespeare Horked Our Script. I think that might be
honestly
one of my favorites of the spoken word.
I think that's it, because it's just I just this whole like sideways admission that it is a Hamlet ripoff is kind of beautiful. Yeah, I kind of like
that. Yeah, and then there's some funny, you know, again, very, very smart for its time, showbiz mockery with a joke about, well, they don't know who I don't want to do a fake Bob and Doug voice, so I won't even try. But they joke about who they don't know who Shakespeare's rep is, and it's possible that through the agencies, you know how agencies send out scripts. How do they know that Shakespeare's agent didn't see it and steal from them? Uh-huh. So there, I think I might, you know, as sort of a theater nerd myself, and I think you are as well, I might join you in agreeing that this is my favorite spoken word cut on the record.
It's a good bit. It's a very good bit.
I'll finish this out just for anyone who's interested. Shakespeare Horkdar script is followed by The Game, which is film dialogue. Mm-hmm. Then we're back to I Did It, You Knob. So before we had I Didn't Do It, You Knob. Now we've got on side two I Did It, You Knob. More dramatic recitations here, actor and director. Then we have The Chase, more film dialogue. Mm-hmm. Then I Did It Again, You Knob. Then the love theme, which we discussed. And finally, another Strange Brew, the sort of extended remix, which I think that becomes the B-side of the 12-inch single. Really, so that's the album.
So we know your favorite. We know your history with it. That's good. Make an argument for why people should listen to this. You have, obviously, this is going to be a weird... Would you tell people to listen to this one first ever? Or would you be like, this is definitely a follow-up?
Definitely a follow-up. Okay. I'll split that in half. Mm-hmm. A follow-up either to the movie or to Great White North. In other words, if you've seen the movie, then you get what these characters are about, and I think you would enjoy the divergence and the tangents and the commentary from the album. Otherwise, for sure, Great White, because it, as much as I enjoy this, you know, Great White is the superior work. I don't think anybody would disagree. And it is the intro to those characters. And so you kind of need that, I think, to even appreciate this as fully.
Yeah, definitely. That's perfect.
I was going to ask you, too, what was your... So you said that you were terrified of the film when you saw it too early. But when did you realize the brilliance of the McKenzie brothers?
I mean, I just grew up with a passing knowledge of them, a love of them both as actors, right? And so just a passing knowledge of, like, this is a thing my mom thought I should find funny, and I didn't get it. And then a guest came on named Ilan Mastai, who's now a writer on I Think This Is Us. I apologize if it's the wrong show. But there's a lot of shows with the same sounding names right now. He's a very good writer. And he's like, I picked The Great White North. Can we listen to that? I'm like, sure. I've never heard that. I guess I should give it a shot. And another friend had recommended it. And it was honestly because of this podcast and having to listen to it. And I was like, fuck. Why didn't I know about this years ago? This is something I would have talked about at the top of the whole podcast because it's that good. So it's only because of the show that I realized how good these were. And now that's in my top 10, maybe top 5 favorite albums of all time.
It kind of blew my mind when Dave Thomas said on your show that they improvised it. Cause I thought, even though it feels loose, I just imagined that it was written.
Sure.
But it wasn't.
None of it.
And so then of course, I think you mentioned this, but if we should expound on it here, it made me think like, wait a minute. In addition to this Strange Brew soundtrack we're talking about, there's got to be miles of tape of stuff that they did to get to Great White North. Where's that?
I guarantee
Criterion.
You,
is there one a criterion?
Person knows. You know what I mean? One person knows. And that person's either forgotten where it is or doesn't want to give it up. Or, it's hard to say. I know.
It's in Geddy Lee's tool shed. It's in Geddy all these like reel-to-reel tapes. But think about it, though. Again, some enterprising company like, if you liked Great White North, and there's doing, look, they just did like gigantic Bowie reissue, and they're putting out this album of his that was like long rumored but never released before. Toy is coming out right now. And so like, certainly, it's a niche, yes, but there is an audience that would go, I would like to hear like a double album with stuff that didn't make Great White North. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Absolutely. It's so funny because like I can sit here and talk with you about it and agree and be like, yes, that should exist because I would buy it and Eddie would buy it. And I can think of many other guests on my show. And then I have one guest who is in the industry and who would be like, you know that makes no sense financially, right? And I'd have to be like, yes, I get that. I get that. However, I want this to exist. Eddie wants this to exist. Please make this happen.
Well, I understand in the sort of pre-digital realm of when it wouldn't make sense to manufacture a physical thing. Okay, sure. I get that.
Sure.
But although there's a lot to be said where so many things are getting Blu-ray releases, movies I would say are pretty niche. And I'm buying them. But so the audio side of that is like, what's your overhead? Like, yeah, okay, you got to pull out the tapes and they probably need to be, you know, digitally baked or whatever they do to bring out, you know, fix the hiss and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then actually getting it on platforms, there's no physical component, so it should be kind of cheap. Like, I would think that, you know, it's more like what your guest is probably really saying is like, it doesn't make sense for the investment because it would make $100. Like, that's the thing. Like, it probably wouldn't go into
for a vinyl anyway, right? If this were a vinyl, like three disc something or other, then yeah, then it wouldn't be worth it. But you're right. Digitally, I think there's
something to be had there. Sure.
Yeah. Why not?
Although I do see also that there are these vinyl releases where I would think, who's going to buy that? Like the Transformers soundtrack. They just from the animated from the 80s. I think they just re-released that.
Yeah.
On vinyl. Does have Dare to Be Stupid on it. That's another one. I do have that, of course. I have the Transformers, but the original one. I didn't pay like some poser to get a re-release. I have the one from the 80s.
If this would be what we are talking about, were it to be vinyl, would be like a perfect record store day kind of thing. And
yes,
you know, one of the bigger companies who could take a hit would probably be fine releasing it as an insane three disc set. And I'm now picturing it. It's beautiful in my head. It's a beautiful looking.
I hope that 3 or 4 years from now, you and I reconvene and we're gloating over the fact that it's happened. We were just a pebble on the path to its fruition.
If this happens, we're absolutely doing an episode of the podcast, even though I'm ending it. Like, I'm doing special episodes here and there. I'll happily do it for that happening. That would be fun.
Yeah.
So this episode comes out, if as planned, I think November 4th. So keep that in mind as you promote yourself, where to find you and your things.
Sure. Oh, you're asking me?
Yes, please promote, good sir.
Oh, sure. I mean, you can, you know, well, you can find me on the Twitter at @Eddie_Schmidt. My stuff, I mean, you can watch Ugly Delicious or Chelsea Does, Chelsea Handler doc series. Both are on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
People should seek out the Gilbert Gottfried documentary, Gilbert. Uh-huh. A Gilbert Gottfried story that I exec produced. Neil Berkeley, whom you enjoyed Beauty is Embarrassing, which I also exec produced. People should find that as well. But worked again with Neil to do the Gilbert Gottfried story.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think it's any comedy fan would really enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of my other stuff is on HBO Max. Some of my more serious stuff like Valentine Road, which is a very worthy documentary. People should seek that out. So yeah, my stuff's out there. It's around. You can find it. Amazon Prime's got some stuff too, I think, that you can check out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's all over the place.
Delightful.
And I hope people enjoyed our conversation. I did. This was really fun.
Me too. This was a lot of fun. And again, we will do it again when there's a third record or a box set that happens. I'm so desperate to, like, can I tell you the number of times I've had somebody come on this show and be like, yeah, we did all this stuff. And then that ended up on, like, we're talking like the guy who produced all the Python records too. It's like, yeah, there are all these verses that were cut out of Life of Brian. And I'm like, excuse fucking me. I'm like, where are they? He's like, yeah, I probably got them in the back somewhere. Basically, they're probably somewhere. And I'm like, fuck.
Oh
no, please release these. So that the shit's out there. At least somebody like him holds on to stuff, and you know, the Python does have official archivists, or at least Terry Gilliam does. His daughter is his archivist. She might be archiving most of the Python stuff. She does a lot of that work. So those people are out there, but there is stuff that I've definitely heard. Like, let's very quickly, sorry to waste everybody's time, I hope this doesn't bore you, but when Paul Dooley was on, he was like telling me, we were talking about his record that I then released digitally, which basically did no work. My friend Taylor Jessen did all the work cleaning it up. But he's like, yeah, I also did a JFK parody album. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, it never got released. Like, it is recorded. It's out there. I know who wrote it. And I've been trying to get in contact with his widow to see if those tapes exist, because that's a weird artifact that I'd like to hear. But I don't know.
Yeah.
He's like, I got paid $200 to do it, and it never ended up anywhere, and I can't find it. So it never got released. So those tapes are
either gone.
Wow.
Or in maybe her possession, one hopes. So wow. Whenever I hear stuff like that, I'm like, shit, that's why I need to win the lottery. I would
sure
disappoint sure. my well, wife by spending all of it on releasing comedy albums that only I want to hear.
Well, you actually, you and your audience would enjoy, speaking of Paul Dooley, there's a great documentary that my friend Heather Ross did. I don't have anything to do with it except getting a thank you, but I liked it, and I think people who are interested in comedy will want to see it. But it's the story of Del Close. It's called The Mad Men Only.
I really want to see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Friend of the show, James Urbaniak, plays Del Close in it.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and my connection there is my cousin is Doc Hammer of the Venture Brothers. So,
oh, really?
See, it's all full circle. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah. That's so funny.
But yeah, James, that's right. He's great in it. I think all those, Patton Oswalt is in it, Matt Walsh. Mm-hmm. Definitely check it out. You will enjoy it, and people who listen to this show will as well.
I really want to see that.
For Mad Men Only.
I very much want to see that, because I was trying to think recently. I was like, somebody needs to make a movie about Del Close. And as I was thinking that, they were clearly in post on this movie, because it just came out right after I had the thought.
She was on it for a really long time. I mean, years and years. And I, mm-hmm. Cheered her on from the sidelines. But yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to bring it back to Bob and Doug for one final thought.
Please, please, yeah.
I was just going to say that the great irony about these beer-swilling comic creations in my mm-hmm. own life mm-hmm. is that years ago, I had to go gluten-free. So I can't even really drink much beer. I can only drink gluten-free beer. So
that's a
when
thing?
I watch this, it is a thing, yeah, for people like me.
Okay.
But so when I watch, there's an extra layer here when I go, beer. I remember beer. Seeing them just quaff beer after beer, I think about what that used to be like. As we mature, we look at things differently.
What's the brand they drink in this? Because Molson wouldn't allow them to use the name.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking to see if it's on the cover here.
I was trying to find it. Because I think Molson got pissed about the mouse thing, and they're like, yes. No thanks.
Yes, they did. We're going to finish, and I'm going to remember what it is.
Yeah. It's very funny, though.
I don't remember.
That's fine. I saw it earlier, but I can't remember what page it was on. I will very quickly just tell everybody, again, hopefully this timing works out. Last episode with Dan Schlissel, we announced that there's a new Dick Davey album coming out, sometime soon. It is in the works and by Stand Up Records. So the comedian whose identity I discovered, if you guys have been following that whole saga, the record will be coming out hopefully sometime early next year, or sometime next year is the hope, on vinyl, my first vinyl anything, even though I'm not on the damn thing. I just wrote the liner notes. So that's happening. You guys should go listen to Dan and Jay's Comedy Hour, which is another podcast that I do that will be one of the few to continue after this is over. And I don't know, that's about it. Eddie, thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you. You're doing a real service here. The whole history of comedy on wax. So I enjoy the show, and I enjoyed being on it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to P.O. Box 725-165, Berkeley, Michigan, 48072. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs, and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!